The Sunstone Foundation presents Mormon Financial Scams. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about
substantial financial losses among their friends and church members. All of this bad news is not confined solely to Utah. When too many of these cases are determined to have involved greed beyond the generally accepted bounds of avarice, lies, misrepresentations, and outright fraud, Mormons cannot help but ask themselves several penetrating questions. These questions might be the following. Number one, are Mormons more prone to be involved in fraud either as the fleecer or the fleecee? Two, what is it about these financial schemes that appeal to Mormons? Do they have common thread, themes, or underlying characteristics? Three, what is it about people in general, and Mormons in particular, that make them susceptible to fraud? And four, what can we do to protect ourselves against these modern-day Gandiantan robbers wearing Gucci shoes and diamond-studded Rolex watches? Today's panel will address these four questions and try to provide some answers. Our panel participants are highly qualified individuals, although I have not selected any of them because they are experts in the perpetration of fraud. Although all of them do have doctoral degrees of one sort or another, and anyone who's familiar with that higher education process of obtaining advanced degrees realize that there's a certain amount of bluff, daring, and deception that at times borders on fraud, albeit not of the financial type. I am Jim Croft. I will serve as a panel moderator and make a presentation. I'm a former professor of statistics at the College of Business here at the University of Utah. I am currently executive vice president of the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, commonly called Freddie Mac. Among my duties include the supervision of our company's efforts to detect, investigate, and prosecute fraud. My company is a multi-billion dollar corporation, and each year we are taken for tens of millions of dollars, by people perpetrating mortgage fraud. In the first 6 months of this year alone, our company has recovered $14 million from fraudulent schemes. We're not even sure how much we have lost. I will address the statistical question. Is there any evidence to suggest that Mormons are more prone to be involved in fraud than other people? Joseph Tesh, our second presenter, is the Chief Deputy Attorney General for the state of Utah. In that capacity, he is second in command in the Attorney General's office. He is a graduate of the Marquette University Law School. He has also taught at that law school. In the state of Wisconsin, he has been an assistant district attorney and an assistant U.S. attorney and has had a great deal of prosecutorial experience. He moved to Utah in 1976 to take a position at the Salt Lake County Attorney's Office and a ski. His assistant told me she's not sure which order those two came in. He's practiced law privately here in the state of Utah, and just last January, he assumed his current position in the Attorney General's office. Mr. Tesh is not a Mormon. He is a Catholic and can present us with an interesting point of view. He will address the question, are there common threads, themes, or characteristics in the financial scams that have been victimizing members of the Mormon community? Joseph Bentley is our third panelist. He's a professor of organizational behavior at the University of Utah's College of Business. He has a PhD in psychology from the University of Minnesota. He's a longtime observer and commentator on idiosyncrasies and foibles of the Mormon culture. He will deal with the question, what is it about people in general and Mormons in particular that may make them more susceptible to financial scams? Our final presenter is Sam Stewart. He is a professor of finance who practices what he preaches. He's the president and CEO of Wasatch Advisors, a local and highly successful investment advisory firm and a money management firm. As an analyst of financial investments and an advisor to anyone who has large pools of money, he's seen his fair share of both strong and weak financial schemes. He will advise us on how we can recognize scams and address the question, what can we do to protect ourselves against con artists and swindlers, as well as the well-meaning, financially desperate wolves in temple clothing. That was my title, Sam. I take full responsibility for that. The phenomenon we are dealing with at this panel is financial fraud. Fraud, by the way, is defined by the Dictionary of Criminal Justice Terminology, which I didn't even know existed until a few weeks ago, as, quote, the intentional misrepresentation of fact to unlawfully deprive persons of his or her property or legal rights without damaging the property or without threatening injury to the individuals. So vandalism, assault, stick-ups, perjury, or garden variety lying aren't included in this definition. It is the intentional misrepresentation of fact to deprive people of their rights or their property. Financial scams are big business in this country. For the year ending in 1985, the year for which the latest data are available, the Bureau of Justice Statistics has told me that there were, in that one year, 64 persons charged in federal cases involving $10 million in losses or more. $10 million in losses or more. 64 persons, that means 640 million dollars at least in fraud in one year. Now that's kind of interesting because by contrast, in that same year, $19 million were lost in bank robberies compared to the 640 just for those 64 people. In that same year, $313 million were lost in burglaries. We all spend a lot of time locking our doors and protecting ourselves against burglars. Some of us even have electronic alarm systems. But just 64 people built United States citizens in that year out of more than double what burglars did and many times more than what bank robbers did to us. Convictions for white-collar crime in the United States are rising at an annual rate of about 6%, according to figures I obtained from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the state of Utah. I suppose the good news is, then, that Mormons are not alone. The bad news is they have a lot of company. At a recent announcement in Washington, D.C., the Council of Better Business Bureaus and NASA, the North American Securities Administrators Association, presented the results of a survey that they had compiled. The survey indicated that in the past 5 years, over a five-year period, that 15,000 United States citizens had lost at least $450 million in financial scams that were based upon the religious beliefs of the people who had been victimized. I would like to give you four examples that they cited in their report, four statistics or four sort of case studies that they mentioned that came out of their survey. First, a former preacher and Sunday school teacher in Arkansas and California is now serving a four-year prison sentence for securities law violations. More than 600 investors in 20 states invested $10 million with this promoter, who promised a no-risk 36% annual return based upon investments in U.S. Treasury bills. Those of you who have invested in Treasury bills know that's an extremely fine return. Investigators found that many of the victims, including the sheriff of Little Rock County, were fundamentalist Christians who believed they were dealing with a man blessed by God with extraordinary business abilities. Sounds to me like their belief was well-founded. The promoter's records indicated that millions of investor dollars were diverted into phony suitcase banks in the Marshall Islands as part of a Ponzi scheme in which the initial investors were paid off with money raised from the new investors. Second example, a Huntsville, Alabama man is now serving a 10-year prison sentence for a financial planning scheme in which he took an estimated $18 million from almost 200 investors, most of them residents of the Huntsville area and members of a particular church. A former accountant, bookkeeper, and trust officer, the self-proclaimed financial planner traded on his role as the treasurer of the largest Baptist church in the state. The Alabama Securities Commission found that the $18 million had been scattered over 40 accounts in 7 banks. The promoter told investors, including a member of Congress, that he was pooling their funds to invest in stocks and promised between 8 and 30% profits per month. One victim stated, "It was sort of comforting to see the biblical verses he printed at the end of his monthly statements." A third example, Ford Oil and Development Incorporated was ordered in 1985 by various state regulators to stop selling stock to investors who were told that the firm was using Old Testament prophecy as the basis for its plans to drill oil in Israel. The promoters cited Moses' blessing to the tribe of Asher in Deuteronomy 33 and 24, which predicted that the feet of the people will be bathed in oil. Investors were told that the drilling would take place in an area of modern-day Israel allotted by the prophet Joshua to the tribe of Asher. The stock scheme, which was heavily promoted on religious radio stations around the nation, resulted in investor losses of several million dollars. And the final example given in this report that came out in Washington a few weeks ago said more than 10,000 Utah investors lost an estimated $215 million in investment swindles in the mid-1980s, according to a state task force. Many of the schemes were promoted within Mormon congregations and involved false claims of connections with the Mormon hierarchy. The rash of religious-oriented scams contributed to the strengthening of the Utah Securities Division and tighter securities regulation within the state. The point of these examples is this. Utahns and Mormons are not alone in their susceptibility to financial scams or to religiously based fraud that prey on faithful victims. I tried to obtain comparative data wherein I would look at the losses due to fraud and financial scams in the state of Utah on a household basis compared to other states, given, of course, Utah's highly Mormon population. And I wanted to compare household data rather than per capita data, as I hear people comparing per capita data. You can't compare per capita data in the state of Utah. We have such a high birth rate and so many little kids that we've just got these little capitas running all around. So per capita, per capita just doesn't work. When you find that Utahns have a lower disease rate, heart disease, lung disease, and cancer rate per capita, it's because those diseases tend to be diseases of the aged. We don't have as many old people as a percentage of our population as other states have. But if you compared our disease rate for whooping cough, measles, mumps, and diaper rash, we'd be right up there with everybody. I found, however, that there are no data kept on losses due to financial fraud on a state-by-state basis. In fact, the data are very, very inaccurate and very incomplete. What data do exist are fairly unreliable, the definitions are vague, prosecutions for financial fraud are far fewer than might be warranted, and the estimates of loss are only guesses, they're inexact. The evidence that we have is largely anecdotal and is compounded by what I would call the pitchfork effect. I was going to call this the halo effect, but the pitchfork effect is sort of the opposite of the halo effect. Angels wear halos. The devil carries a pitchfork. The pitchfork effect deals with these financial scams wherein a Utah scam is automatically classified in many people's minds as a Mormon scam. So is any fraud which is perpetrated by anybody that ever lived in Utah or who has ever been a Mormon. The media coverage and informal discussions that we have among ourselves sometimes overplay the Mormonness of the crimes of the frauds that are involved. I think we set ourselves up for this. We portray ourselves as being awfully, awfully good. And when we aren't awfully good, that makes news and that makes grist for the rumor mill. It's a little like my brother, who is a former Marine. He said, when anybody gets in trouble, and they are a former Marine, it always mentions that a former Marine did thus and so. But if they were in the Navy or the Air Force or the Army, do you ever hear that? The answer is no. It's in part because the Marines have set themselves up as a few good men, and they have cultivated a certain image. We cultivate a certain image in Mormonism, and when we don't live up to that image, it's news, and it makes a lot of press time. Also, at times, legitimate business failures where investors lose their funds are viewed as just another Mormon scam. As an East Coast Mormon, I can testify to the disdain which any investment plan emanating out of Utah or communicated through LDS channels receives when it reaches the East Coast. Just another Utah investment scheme. Yesterday morning, there was a presentation given by Warner Woodworth that I believe suffers from the same problems of this pitchfork effect. Professor Woodworth discussed unethics, business unethics on the Wasatch Front, and he lumped legitimate business failures together with legitimate Mormon frauds where Utahns and Mormons were victims, together with anything in Utah where money was lost, and didn't define well what he was referring to. But I think he expressed the frustration that many of us feel that we see so much fraud, so many cases hitting the newspaper, that we say, what in the world is happening to this community that ought not have this level of fraud and corruption? I mentioned to Professor Woodworth, by the way, that he should be here to defend himself against my charges that he had been very unfocused and that he had presented us with a morass of things that didn't fit together. And he informed me that by this time today, he would be well on his way to the Philippines. And I said, in that case, I'll really take you on. In my mind, our definitions need to be more precise. I think we need to differentiate between Mormons as perpetrators of fraud, Mormons as victims of fraud, frauds that occur in Utah but are not particularly Mormon-related. Even if we did differentiate, however, I believe we would have our share of interesting cases that we could discuss and that will be discussed later in our panel presentation. Despite the lack of data that we have and despite our inability, I believe, to prove that Mormons are more prone to being involved in fraud, there is a widely held perception, both in Utah and outside Utah, that Salt Lake is the fraud capital of the United States. I have a friend and business associate who has a very successful business based here in Utah. He has a national reputation for his capabilities to deal with certain issues. He told me recently, though he is not a Mormon, he loves Utah, he loves living here, he was meeting on Wall Street in New York with the firm of Solomon Brothers. And when he was meeting with this firm and several people in the meeting found out he was from Utah, they immediately held him at arm's length. But when he said, I'm not a Mormon, they said, oh. And by their body language, invited him back into the discussion. And he has said to me, Jim, I am tired of trying to explain to people outside the state of Utah that I'm not a Mormon. What can we do about it? The widely held perception is also illustrated by the fact that I called, in preparing for this, I called the Director of White Collar Crime for the Federal Bureau of Investigations in Washington, D.C. I told him I was looking for data by state to compare the financial fraud in Utah with other states to see if Utah had a greater rate. He said, no data exists, but why do you need data? Everybody knows that Utah is the worst place in the country. The skepticism about things coming out of Utah even extends to things such as cold fusion. People have been heard to say, perhaps inside the state, but I know outside the state, is this just another one of those Mormon scams? I don't even know whether those people engaged in this a cold fusion experiment are Mormons or non-Mormons. But there is a taint on virtually everything that touches this state due to the perception that there is a great deal of fraud going on here. Let me close by giving you four conclusions that I have reached. Number one, there is no hard evidence that Mormons are more susceptible to financial fraud schemes than other groups. Our evidence is still anecdotal. Nevertheless, there is a vague and widely held perception that Utah, the headquarters of Mormonism, is also the fraud capital of the United States. Two, similar anecdotal evidence exists for financial scams among other religious groups. Three, I believe we need a more precise definition of what Mormon financial scams are, or perhaps even a classification of them before we can really discuss them intelligently. It's my opinion that a sharp definition of Mormon financial scams would perhaps reduce slightly our overall estimate of the rate of fraud among Mormons and among Utahns in general. And four, despite all of this, I still harbor a deep suspicion that the rate of financial fraud we would find among Mormons is far higher than I accept as that I find personally acceptable. Thank you. Joe?
I'm Joe Tesh from the Attorney General's office, and I, because of the things I intended to say, as I ran past the Attorney General, Mr. Van Dan suggested that I tell you that these are my personal views. So I do that. I think, let me give you a little background. I did spend 17 years in Catholic schools. That's all I've ever been to. I have a brother who was a priest. I have a sister who was a nun, and grew up in an Irish Catholic family in an Irish Catholic town, in Polish town, but in the city of Milwaukee to this day, the majority of the people are Catholic. It's not a great majority, but it's over 50%. I think it's in the 53 to 55% range. I grew up in a Catholic neighborhood where I was expected to hang around with Catholic people, where my neighbors who were not were somewhat suspect, that we looked at anybody who went to a public school as being somewhat heathen, probably, and wondered, you know, what great sins went on behind those great doors that we could never go to, was, you know, in a church that strongly and greatly encouraged. My family was economically poor. Our school cost $10 a year, taught by nuns who made nothing. But still, it was a hardship on a family of eight with a low income. You know, the kind of family where you wore pair of pants during the week, it got washed on the weekend, and those were your good pants. And last year's pants is what you wore on the weekend. So, I have some sense of what it's like to live in a place where there is a religious polarity. I will tell you that I don't practice much these days because I found the institution of religion not to fit me well. I will tell you that my brother, who is an ex-priest, reminds me a lot of you folk. He's not an ex because he wanted to be. He's an ex because he came to be a theological difference with his bishop. And his bishop then took all his jobs away. It was a birth control issue. So he took all his jobs away, and then he had no job, and eventually he was defrocked. But it didn't deter him. He went on and continued to say, "I am a priest of Christ," and today runs missions in the not in the Bahamas, yeah, in the Bahamas, actually, and in Mexico and some other areas where they run some schools in a different non-denominational Christian organization. So I have some understanding, I think, as Jim explained it to me, of your relative position with regard to some members that are more tied, perhaps more closely tied to the formal structure of your church. I think I was asked to talk about frauds. I would like to tell you that we do have a great problem in this state, which I love. I'm sure I'll be buried here because I truly love this state, and I don't think anybody could ever move me out of it. But we have great problems with the perception of the Utah businessman and the perception of the amount of fraud that occurs here. I don't know if it's true or not. I really don't. I don't know that anybody does know whether it's true that it's more prevalent here. But we know there's a lot here. in taking the Attorney General's office, one of the things that we found out was that there had been, for about 20 years, a laissez-faire attitude towards business. Don't restrict business too much. Don't prosecute business. I think that there is a conservative perception that laissez-faire to business is good, that business needed to have free rein to grow. But what we found out during the campaign and afterwards by talking with people from the FTC and other businessmen from other parts of the country, that was this. The state of Utah does not get its fair share of investment capital. It doesn't come here. We do not get per capita, for instance, if we can talk that way, or per household, maybe. The same amount of venture capital that, for instance, would go into Colorado or Denver. And the reason we don't get that is that there is a perception that there is a free-for-all going on here. That if you want to make an investment in the state of Utah, watch out, because the laws aren't enforced and Mormon businessmen can't be trusted. So we are, in fact, our economy is suffering because of that perception that there was a free-for-all going on here and that there were not legitimate restraints on how your money could be used if you invested it in the state of Utah. And that causes a great deal of suffering to all of our low-income families, to all of us, I guess, in the sense of our tax structure and the fact that our economy is not what it is in the neighboring states. So in the Attorney General's office, this small commercial, and then I'll get on to some other things, we have created a fair business unit, and it's brand new to this Attorney General, where we have created a unit of 6 lawyers at the moment. We're going to ask for more to do nothing but investigate and prosecute businesses who aren't dealing fairly and with the confines of the law. We think if we can do that, prosecuting bad businesses, prosecuting fraudulent businesses is important. The crime of fraud in business is a well-thought-out crime. It doesn't just occur on the spur of the moment. It's done because it's economically smart. And whereas the prosecution of a murder or a rape doesn't reduce the numbers of murders or rapes or the numbers of husbands who will kill their wives or wives who will kill their husbands in heat of passion, the prosecution of bad business does have a great deterrent effect. And while we could never stop entirely and completely fraudulent business activity, we can make the assessment that it pays be reassessed and have businessmen say, I'm not willing to take the risk. I might be branded criminal. I might be caught. People care now. People are going after fraudulent activity. So we sort of go about it in that fashion. I would like to, in my examples, I've been asked to talk about specific examples, and Jim, I'm afraid I'm not going to talk about a great many specifics, but I can talk about some characteristics of the Granada case, for instance, Dean Larson, the Gary Sheets matter, AFCO, and some of the other major frauds that went on, and tell you what I think are sort of common themes that have run through those things, and I would like to then relate them to some differences that I think I may have perceived in this community versus the community that I came from before here, where I spent the first 33 years of my life. And I will tell you that a common theme in those is that the person perpetrating the theme has had stature in the Mormon Church. I don't really know, and I haven't really studied your hierarchy. I know you have elders, I guess. Those are the guys on the lowest rank, although I really don't know. But in any event, they've been bishops and above, so to speak, and they've been people who have been willing to use that position, if by no other means than by innuendo, that they are somehow ordained and blessed and honest and trustworthy. To get people to swallow hook, line, and sinker fantastic thoughts. And from the point of view of the perpetrator of those frauds, frequently, let me kind of get into this, and I'm just going to mush around a little bit, so if you're taking notes, you're going to leave a lot of spaces. But there is a perception, true or not, that there is a threat of Calvinism in Mormonism. That although the Bible says, and although it's pushed a little bit in the Catholic Church, that it's harder for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than a rich man to get into heaven, it's not very heavily read or emphasized in either religion. It's easy for me to talk about that because I work for the government and don't make any money. So I've got an inside track, but my suspicions are if this was the highest paying job in Utah, I probably wouldn't quit it so I could get to heaven. So it's a difficult concept to sell in this day and age. And yet my own observations are sort of these. These guys begin as good men. These bishops get good ideas. And they think they have great investment opportunities that they can push. And they're successful, and they're viewed as successful. And my impression is that if you see somebody operating at this financial appearance up here, that there is a perception that they're blessed, and that the deity has looked favorably upon that person. And I think that's, I don't know if there's a theological basis or care for it, but I perceive that, rightly or wrongly, from my point of view in this community, that if you're successful in making money and have an appearance of operating at this financial strata, you're perceived to have been blessed. And what often happens, and some of the things that have happened in these schemes that have started out legitimately, is that the people operating up here aren't able to maintain it. That with financial investments, for instance, there's a downturn in the economy, so that you have five or six partnerships that were making money that are now on the verge of bankruptcy, perhaps. So what do you do? Well, there's a great deal. If you believe that you're blessed up here, if you have to drop down a couple of rungs and operate down here, then the inverse has to be true. You're no longer blessed. And that the mandate has been withdrawn to some extent. So that what I think I'm seeing to some degree in dealing with these sorts of scams are people who are then committing frauds on others to be able to maintain the appearance of the financial success two rungs above what they're doing. And it's a social and religious pressure to appear to be blessed. Let me say it as crudely as I can say it, and that is you've got a bunch of people running around stealing from each other trying to look holy. It's a funny way of putting it, but there, I think, is a kernel of truth in it. When you take a guy like Dean Larson, he's not been convicted, and you need to know that. We had about a three-week preliminary examination on him not so long ago, and that preliminary examination was simply to determine whether or not there was probable cause for him to actually be tried for these 68 counts of fraud. We take a guy like him, and we see that initially he was creating limited partnerships and joint ventures which were honest, which had the idea that they were going to make money for the investors, which he was promising, you know, with no risk, 30% returns. And there was a time when the economy was so booming that was puffing. And to say there was no risk was not true. But nonetheless, you might be able to say to yourself, if things keep going well, we might be able to do this. We might be able to pull this off. And I expect that I will, because I'm confident in myself, be able to pull this off. But then what happened in those is that one or two partnerships would become failures. And often many of them would become failures, so that you might have six different investments. Invest in a mobile home park over here, 10 investors. Invest in an amusement park over here, 10 investors. Invest in housing development in Las Vegas, 10 investors. And they started to lose money. So that there was a perception that, I think there are a few elements here, but let me state in the first one, that the first was the idea that I have to continue to appear successful. So there was a beginning of pilfering from Peter to pay Paul. And there was a justification for that. In addition to appearing successful, and a lot of the money went into the pockets, and these people, believe it or not, would take the position, I had to continue to look successful to continue to get investors. Well, some of that is true. Some of it was simply the social pressure of trying to continue to look blessed and not have to fall down on the religious ladder. And I think it's there. I truly think it's there. I may be wrong because there's no way I would have of knowing it, but from an outsider's point of view, it looks like there's a bit of that there. And it might do well for the people to remind each other that financial success is not equated with blessedness. And it might be something that could be paid attention to. The other thing that I think I see in the manner of this operation of people in that hold official positions in the church is a statement of shepherd and flock. That it may be a technicality in the law that says, if Harry gave me the money to put it into the homes, I can't put it anywhere else. But I'm trying to save all four investments schemes. So even though Harry gave it to me for the home building, I, in fact, am going to use it for the mobile home park. Because in a little while, I'll be able to turn it all around and make it all go. Therefore, I have, for the good of all, misused the one. And really not misused him. I've just borrowed his money without his permission for the good of the flock. And I think that emanates a little bit from that bishopric. That it's okay, that my intentions are good. I intend to help everyone, and therefore I borrowed Harry's money without his permission. The problem is the whole damn thing goes sour. And Harry didn't give him permission. And Harry said, put it in A, and he put it in B, and it's lost. And now Harry is on the rocks, as is his family. And his kids can't go to the same schools anymore and the same colleges, and they can't live in the same neighborhood. Not because of anything Harry did, but because the bishop decided to be shepherd over the flock. And on his own, with good intentions, I think in his mind, use the assets of one to help buoy up the whole on the hopes that the economy will come around so that he can do well for everyone. The strange phenomena that I've seen prosecuting frauds here versus prosecuting frauds in Milwaukee are how nice our criminals are in their own mind. It's truly shocking. Been very much an amazement to me to catch people who have been acting with great fraud, taking money and living high on the hog, and have been doing what the law doesn't permit, have been taking Harry's money and using it for Fred without his permission, and who nonetheless perceive themselves to be terrific individuals, who are absolutely righteous and stunned that they're being prosecuted as criminals. In Milwaukee, the crooks knew they were crooks. I mean, that was real easy. Yeah, you got me, you asshole, and I'll get you when I get out.
It was clear, you know. I thought I could get away with it, you know. And by God, when I get out, I've learned now and I'll do it better. But around here, honestly, it isn't so. They believe they're being persecuted. They believe that they're being unfairly tried, and in their own mind, they do not believe they have done anything wrong. And that's been stunning, and I want to make one other observation about that that I think involves your theology a little bit. I remember all the way back to first grade, Sister Cecilia. I remember her because I still have sores on my knuckles, I think. But we had a catechism, and it didn't mean anything then, but we memorized and gave answers. And in first grade it said, what is God? God is good. You know, what is truth? Truth is God. God is truth. And maybe it was in second grade where you didn't say God is good, but God is goodness. God is goodness. The definition of goodness is what God is. What God does, how God operates, defines what is good. So if that God that made us was a damned liar, then lying would be good. I mean, that's what it means. Goodness is defined by the nature of God. And I think that that's what all the early Christians believed. And I think right up to the 5th century when Augustine sort of came in and said men weren't good. And we had something called concupiscence and all that business that I don't know much about. But in any event, you have in your theology, and I think it comes through a little bit. I've noticed it in my individual relationships with returned missionaries a little bit. And I've noticed it in criminals who are white-collar criminals. And that is a belief in the godhood of them. And I think there's something in your theology about that, that if you work hard and follow the scriptures, follow the Book of Mormon, that you in fact can become God. And I don't know if that's a growth process, that you're a little bit God now and more God as you get better and better until you get a domain. I don't know enough about it, and I don't mean to make fun of it. I just don't know if it's a boom or if it's a growth into, which is it? It's a growth. We believe funny things as Catholics. So it's. I don't, by saying is it a boom, mean to suggest that that would be a funny way of believing about it. But I think people who have worked hard in the church, who in their own mind have felt that they have followed the scriptures the best they could, at least the males as I understand it, and our frauds have all been males so far, at least the ones we've caught. But there is a perception that they are a bit like God. And I think what I see just a little bit is that their actions define what's right. They don't need to find it in a book. They don't need to read it anywhere. It may be other than what the law says you can do. But because I am part God and sincere in trying to help, and my intentions are good, the fact that I did it makes it right. God is goodness. God is righteousness. I am God. So that we get to a situation, and I'm stunned by that, the disbelief that they've done anything wrong. And while I have had no education or have done no study in your religion other than what I read in the newspaper and talk to my friends about, many of whom are practicing and bright and enjoyable people and Mormons and sincere Mormons, I see a bit of that. And I think some of these frauds are there. I think there is a belief, the Timpanogos case, those doctors that took $3.2 million, the fact that they could in their own mind and to this very day believe they did nothing wrong, that they were doing what they should be doing, I can only explain by defining goodness in the sense of I did it and I'm godlike and I'm ordained and I'm favored and therefore it must have been the right thing to do. Defining the action by who I am and what I did sincerely, as you mentioned. It's a strange sort of way of looking at things, and yet I think I'm saying it a bit. So I don't know if I'm running over. I guess I am, Jim, and I apologize. I had a few more thoughts, but they're no better than what I've already given you. Thank you.
And then we'll get to it in a minute. My role is to comment on human nature, beings, people, why we act as we do. Why am I qualified to do that? I have spent all of my professional life thinking about why we do things, how can we understand those things, what makes sense to us. Let me make two quick comments on what Jim and Joe have said to you. One, perception. There is a perception of fraud. One of the most important rules in the social sciences is this. If we believe something to be true, it is in fact true in its consequences. So it makes little difference whether it is factually true or not. The perception is very powerful, and it makes it true in its consequences, that is, if this fraud does exist. Second point related to what Joe said. We are the most skillful in the universe at justifying what we do. All of us, not just people who commit fraud, all of us can justify in logical, sincere ways that what we do is right, even if it says somewhere else that it isn't right. It's one of our greatest capacities as human beings. And it allows us to survive in a world where we cannot keep up with all the rules and regulations. So some of us are cruel and mean to our children, but we justify. Some of us tell lies and are dishonest, but we can justify that. So rather than being unusual and strange, it's an extension. Granted, a serious one, but it's an extension of part of our human nature. To make what we do right and logical and reasonable because I do it and it makes perfectly good sense to me. You may not understand it, but from my point of view, it makes good sense. Are Mormons more prone, first, to commit fraud and second, to be fraudees, that is, to be defrauded? I don't know. No one knows, as we've heard. But the perception is there, therefore, the reality exists. We're suffering the consequences of that. I would like to talk about, very briefly, the question, how do we make our way in this world? From infants with practically no understanding of the nature of the world to adults who can express wisdom, how do we do that? In other words, what's the nature of experience and how does it work? One answer that the social scientists give is that we construct maps of the world, cognitive maps, literally maps in our heads. You have them, I have them. Those maps are connected to nebulous terms like justice and truth and beauty. They're connected to things like success. You have a map for success in your head. I do too. You have certain guidelines by which you follow. Those are products of... One quick story to give you an example, and then to talk about this particular diagram. During the Battle of Okinawa in the Second World War, the Marines reported curious noises at night. It turned out to be people shouting these things: to hell with Babe Ruth, to hell with Lou Gehrig, and to hell with Mo Berg. Now these came from Japanese intelligence experts who were trying to break the spirit of the Marines so that they would not resist. To hell with Lou Gehrig, to hell with Babe Ruth, to hell with Mo Berg. It turns out that in the Japanese culture, with respect for public figures, especially baseball players, they believed, according to their maps, that if you denigrated those great baseball stars, people would be devastated. Marines really didn't care. Secondly, the Marines didn't even know who Mo Berg was. Mo Berg turned out to be an American player who went to play in Japan before the war and was a national hero. He couldn't hit a curveball. But he was the American epitome of baseball. He was the one who played in Japan. Now, what does this mean in terms of the maps we make in our head? The first O has to do with order. We construct an orderly world, all of us. So in the Japanese orderly world, respect for authority, respect for figures is very important. Not in ours, in the same way.
This is meaning.
The meaning of the terms Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and Moe Berg, the Marines understood the first two. They didn't understand Moe Berg. It didn't work.
The last one is membership. That is, those groups of people with whom we associate and acquire our values. This map can be called a world view. Is there a world view for Mormons? I'm a member of the Mormon community, and I say yes, there is. We share a world view about the order of things, the meaning of things, and the nature of membership. And it's within that, in that triangle, that we develop the tendency, the propensity to be defrauded or to commit fraud in the name of certain principles. There is a Promised Valley worldview. It's unique to this valley. And if you've lived elsewhere and been active in the church, you know what that means. It's a different world. Let me talk a little bit about the order, meaning, and membership in our heads, collective maps, Mormon maps, that may make us more susceptible, either to commit fraud, we're speculating. One, we have an exchange view of religion. Do good and you'll be blessed. Keep the commandments and you'll be rewarded. Look up the number of times reward appears in the indices to our scriptures. It's essential in our religious scheme of things that you are rewarded. That is, good, righteous behavior becomes instrumental for something else. It isn't, in our scheme of things, good because it is good. Suppose, for example, the scripture said, keep the commandments and nothing good may ever happen to you, but just keep them because it's the right thing to do. That's not the way we think. We keep the commandments so we will be rewarded. So we have an expectation of reward in our exchange view of theology. Second, we have in this order of things, we have a personal God relationship. God cares about you. God cares about me. It's personalized. It's not an amorphous first cause. God knows me, watches over me, protects me, takes care of me, and will get me out of tight spots. We believe that. We act that. We may not externalize it. We believe in a just world, number three. There's a book written about belief in a just world, a fundamental delusion. Our belief in a just world is very strong, connected to our exchange view of things. It's connected to our personal relationship with God. And it goes like this. You get what you deserve. And if you get bad things, you must have deserved it. And if you get good things, you also must have deserved it. Fourth, in our order of things, we see ourselves as a special, elect, set-apart people. Partly from our historical heritage, partly from our conception of God's chosen group. We and the Jews have set ourselves apart as elect of God. And God takes care of his elect. The next essence of order is our middle-class, upwardly striving church. We are middle class. We value education. We have all the bourgeois values of sacrifice, hard work, saving, investing. And put that together with an economic system, which we call capitalism, which talks about returning money on investments. And we become ready for people coming to us to offer to invest our funds so that they will return to us. Finally, we have comfort in authority-based relationships. Not only comfort, but we find answers in those relationships, those ecclesiastical relationships. We find comfort, and when authority people present themselves in authoritative ways, we listen. That, in some ways, those are part of the things that amazes Joe about how nice criminals are. We're middle-class, respectable, educated people. Going on very quickly so that I won't take up too much time, the meaning dimensions of our worldview, the Promised Valley worldview, are things like this. We have shared justification schema. That is, we justify behaviors in a joint way. We
We are a business-oriented, capitalistic-oriented, conservative-oriented community. And so, business is business. I am a victim of fraud, not because I invested my money, but because I did work for a man who then cheated me out of $50,000. It's a lot of money for a university professor, an awfully lot of money, who was a member of a high council and later became a stake president. An anecdote, but it has colored my experience. But his answer to me was, business is business. Look, I had to take the money I owed you and I had to put it somewhere else because I had these crying needs. And look, don't personalize that money. Separate it. Now, there is a challenge. Part of our meeting system is progress is extremely important. How do we know we are ahead this year than last year? We are not cyclical. We're not glad when spring comes around again because it's spring. We're wondering whether we are further ahead when spring comes around again. We're on our way somewhere in terms of what Joe was saying. We have, in terms of our meaning systems, we have high needs for belonging and for inclusion compared to other peoples. Moving on very quickly so we'll have time for questions. What about membership? We are a closely connected, networking people. Go to a sacrament meeting, we talk, we value, the neighborhood comes together. If you're not a member of the church and you live in that neighborhood, you understand the meaning of closely connected because you're left out, unless it's a unique and rather unusual situation. The membership issues have to do with the meaning issues as well, but we are what are called in anthropological terms closely coupled networking systems. We value each other's company. And some critics of our religion have said, in some ways, we are so social that we lose sight of the theological aspects of our church. Well, these represent very briefly elements that might, I believe, would make us more susceptible to fraud, to falling into those schemes that could represent progress, that could represent authority, that could represent success, that could represent success in the name of a capitalistic economy where returning on investment is a very critical element. Finally, let me just end by saying that these maps we carry in our head, we consult often to guide us in our decisions and our choices. These maps may be metaphorical, they may be real. They may, in fact, be representational. Brain researchers are now looking at electrical parallel processing systems in our brains that have characteristics related to maps. As long as these maps are not examined and looked at and explored and questioned, we're unable to change them. They represent the reality of things. But if you study history or anthropology or the social sciences or literature, you find out that the nature of order, the nature of meaning, and the quality of membership is dramatically different in other cultures, in other nations, and other societies. So we're not necessarily locked into these. Are Mormons more prone to commit fraud? I don't know. But I believe Mormons are more trusting, more believing, more authority-related, more idealistic, more progress-oriented, more socially connected, and more optimistic than people in general, and even than religious people in general. And those qualities can lead people to becoming more susceptible to fraud. Thank you.
Well, I think Jim selected Joe and Joe because they had a lot to say, and I think he selected me because I didn't have very much to say, and he knew that these two gentlemen would use up a fair amount of time, and he wanted to preserve some question and answer, which I think is good in a session like this. And so I have very little to say, and I'll say it briefly. Jim asked me to address the issue of what could we do to protect ourselves and what could the church do to protect us. Before answering those questions, I would like to take one step back and just ask the question, what is going on here? If we were dealing with a high-rolling, hard-charging, fast-living group of investors, and I saw in the last week the movie Great Balls of Fire, which told the life story of Jerry Lee Lewis. This doesn't look like a Jerry Lee Lewis crowd. Maybe none of you know who Jerry Lee Lewis is. He is. Yeah. Anyway, he is a rock and roll singer who's lived a very wild life. And if I were to open the newspaper and find that Jerry Lee Lewis had invested with John Vasilikopoulos in his diamond scheme, I would say, well, yeah, what do you expect? It's like when you open the newspaper and you find that some Hollywood movie star is tied up in some tax shelter scam. You say, well, what do you expect? But what we have here is something very, very different. We have conservative, cautious, church-going, hard-working, budget-minded people who are investing all of their life savings, and in Grant Affleck's case, more than their life savings, in schemes that are palpable, errant nonsense. I mean, they're absurd schemes. They're not even credible. And I think as Joe talked a little bit about perception and reality and so forth, you are dealing with people, normally prudent people, who in this case, for some reason, don't want to be prudent. And so I ask the question, what is going on here? What is it that makes people go along this straight and narrow track and then all of a sudden go way off and go way off quickly? I've had some personal contact with this, and I will tell you one or two anecdotes. I received a call one day when I was at the university. This girl called me in my capacity as a finance professor to check on some interesting investment opportunity that she had heard about. Well, it turned out to be John Vasilikopoulos' deal. And I don't know if you're familiar with, but basically John claimed to be able to somehow buy and sell diamonds. They had a particular relationship with the distributors, and they would buy these diamonds and then resell them in such a way as to earn interest rates that were 10-15% a month interest rates. And this girl came to me and she said, you know, my husband and I have been saving for a down payment on our home, and this opportunity to earn 10 or 15% a month is so good, because she could do a little bit of math and figured out at 10 or 15% a month, you're doubling and tripling and quadrupling your money in very short periods of time. And she said, this is a great thing, and I just wanted to check it out with you. And I said, well, it is not a great thing. And then I went through and, you know, how could it happen? And I went through all of the professor-like things, all of the things that Jim wants me to tell you about. He wants me to tell you these things. And she said, she listened, and I could tell it was just going right through. She said, well, it's all very interesting what you've told me, but you can make so much money doing this. So I am not going to do what Jim asked me to do in terms of what you can do. If you're serious about being prudent, these schemes will appear ridiculous to you. You won't have to spend 30 seconds on them because they're so silly. Any reasonable, rational person would not invest in these schemes. It's not hard to tell them. It's easy. The real problem is, what happens to people that makes them all of a sudden, having lived this very abstemious, cautious life, all of a sudden go off at right angles? And that, I think Joe and Joe have spoken very well on, and I'm just going to add a couple of brief things, and they're really just amplifying and modifying. I would say, It comes under the category, what can the church do? And again, there are some easy things that the church can do that they're already doing. They say, stay out of debt. We get talks in general conference, especially since we've had the frauds and scams, avoid the frauds and scams. And the church tells us what to do. But all of a sudden, these people don't want to listen to the church. You know, they've listened for years and years and years, and all of a sudden, they don't want to listen. So we need to talk about something a little deeper, and I think it is in the culture. I think that's the problem, and if the church wanted to address this problem, they could try to change the culture. I don't know if that's possible. What I do know is that in the business school, we talk a lot these days about corporate culture, what makes some companies one way and what makes some companies another way, and can we change that? And I would say there are two things in our Mormon culture that amount to a 1-2 punch. And unfortunately, a lot of members have glass chins, and they get 1-2, and there are some people can stand up to it, but a lot can't, unfortunately. The first punch in our culture is this Calvinistic streak that both Joseph, come on, we are externally oriented, we're materialistically oriented, not in the doctrine, mind you, very important, not in the doctrine, but in the culture. I think all you need to do is think, I call it the, I need to make more money so I can pay a lot of tithing syndrome. Okay? Now you laugh, but I have had many, many people say that to me with a straight face. And it is exactly this idea that if I have the external trappings, that is a sign that I have been given the internal blessings, that I am righteous. It's always fascinated me that Salt Lake City is tied with Beverly Hills, California, for being the Mercedes capital of the United States. It has always interested me that when we're hearing about, when we open the church news and we read about this success story was first in the class, this success story was here, there, everywhere. The BYU sports, there are actually some schools, some religious schools that would give up sports because they don't like the competitive aspect. But we take BYU and parade their success, and that is very, very important. And, of course, there's always the old anecdote. Why isn't the janitor the stake president? We've heard that many times, and they never are. The stake presidents are always very, very successful people. Now, this is a very big bombardment on my cautious, conservative, church-going guy. He is bombarded in the culture by these messages, and he is not successful in these big worldly terms because he's never taken a risk. He's never rolled the dice. And at some level, in his mind, he knows that if you're going to make it big, you got to roll the dice. And so the culture says to be successful spiritually, you got to make it big. And he knows that if you don't roll the dice, you'll never make it big. So that is the first punch. The idea that success is measured in these external terms. The second punch is the stress that we place on obedience. Jim is one of these. I can testify because I've known Jim for a number of years. He's one of these cautious, conservative Mormons. And he said, Sam, I want you to be here at 10:30. I know the session begins at 11, but I want you to be here at 10:30. Now, Jim knows that I am one of these cautious, conservative Mormons. And if this authority figure tells me to be here at 10:30, even though I say, well, wait a minute, you know, 10:30, a half an hour, I got something I can do with my time. I show up at 10:30. And so I'm sitting here in the previous presentation. The guy probably wonders, what are these people doing streaming in here? It's not. Anyway, I picked up something very important. We have heard many, many times, obedience is the first law of heaven. We hear that as Mormons. And he said, you know, I researched that, and I could never find anybody that said it. Of course, everybody says it now, but I can't find Joseph Smith didn't say it, Brigham Young didn't say it. It's not in the Bible. I can't find anybody that said it. So, but we believe that as Mormons. And that gives us a couple of things. One of the things I think that it gives us is it gives us a kind of an exaltation, an unquestioning acceptance of authority figures. And I have a name for this. We have the 10-year-old, 40-year-old syndrome. Got a lot of mature, physical people in this church that behave like 10-year-olds in the sense that we have heroes, we have these authority figures, and gosh, you know, if they say to do something, we're going to do it. And the other thing I think that comes from that is a childlike, easy acceptance of strangers. So we have somebody like Grant Affleck who drives his Mercedes up and gets out and is in a nice suit and has a flip chart that has a general authority's picture on it. And we accept. And we accept because we're attuned to this obedience. And with that second punch, too many people fall. Now, whether or not the church would ever address these cultural issues, I don't know. But certainly, we need to recognize if we're worried about falling victim, as part of this culture, we're susceptible to having our heads turned by worldly success, and we're susceptible to the things that come with obedience. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I hope there's some good and lively discussion that we can get going. Thank you.
We do have some time for questions. I've asked the panel members to come up here. We'll pass a microphone back and forth so that the recording can get the responses. For those of you who have questions, please indicate to whom you would like to direct them. For the short questions, I'll try to summarize them so we can get them on tape. If you have an observation that is quite involved, I would ask you to come up here and grab the microphone yourself so that we can preserve that. Yes?
I have a question for Sam and then one for Joe Tesh real quickly. First of all, Sam, what the church can do to help this out on this problem, I'd just like to mention something that I believed in for a long time and been talking about, but I haven't seen anything done about it. I'd like to get your comment on it. Don't you think it would be helpful if the church, and this I think would be very easy for the church to do and not threatening to the church at all, in fact, the benefits are, I think, would be enormous. Don't you think the church, instead of having many of these lessons in our manuals that have just pure pablum in them, can't they start having a series of lessons in the priesthood Sunday school manuals on honesty and breaking them down into various categories of power and greed and conflict of interest and employee theft, cheating on exams in schools, and then handling them like they do in law schools and in business schools on a simplified basis, of course. But what I'm getting at is having case histories presented, of course without mentioning names, but just hypothetical cases, and then have the group discuss in each class what would be wrong or right in this. Even if we don't reach unanimous conclusions, at least it would get the members to start thinking before they start cheating someone out of something. So, well, now wait a minute, I discussed that in my class last Sunday. Maybe I better think about this again. The other question I have is for...
Okay, first question is for Sam Stewart. Shouldn't the church have a program where in its classes it emphasizes basic ethics as opposed to some of the other things that the current programs emphasize? Sam, would you like to respond?
Yes, we could do that. The one thing I would like to emphasize is in terms of the culture, it is so inbred that I don't know how effective those kinds of things will do until you start getting rid of and really restructuring the culture. So, by all means, let's give it a try.
I mean, in addition to what you're saying, yes.
One of the things that I asked a bunch of people, why do they think Mormons are susceptible? And one person came up with an interesting idea, and it goes along with this gentleman's suggestion, and that is Mormons tend to respond to programs. They're over-programmed. They have a home teaching program to show you how to be a good friend. And we have a missionary program with lots of steps in it to show you how to convert people. And we have the youth program and the genealogy program and the scouting program, but we don't have any programs in ethics, so nobody knows how to do it. Okay. Let's go to one other. I would like to spread these around if we could. We'll get back to you if we have some time. A comment saying we should teach people to be cynics and skeptical if we could do so without inflicting a great deal of pain on them.
Yes. Joe, on the Sagiri sheets, he was a pathological optimist.
A request for Joe Tesh to comment on the Gary Sheets case.
That was tried by the federal prosecutor. There were a few things. That was a very disturbing case. And I can tell you, in getting ready to try Dean Larson, we went over and talked to that prosecutor and said, what the hell went wrong here? And a number of things, of course. Gary's wife had been killed, which was a great sympathetic matter. Number two, he was an extreme optimist. And one of the things that you have to prove when proving fraud is that there is an intent to steal the money. And the prosecutor was stunned and kept arguing that what the jury did was wrong. And I walked out of his office saying he has no idea why he lost that case, because he really hadn't done any of this work. And I can't even remember his name, and I don't mean to criticize him, but he didn't understand a Mormon jury. He didn't understand that sympathy loomed as death to his case in that courtroom, that he didn't understand that it had to be a very artfully well-tried case. And I think the sympathy and the fact that he was just, Sheets was just able to sell the idea that he never intended to take anybody's money. It was sort of what I said. I may have borrowed from that a little while, but I certainly didn't intend to keep it. And I think the facts prove the elements of the crime. The jury found him innocent, as juries can do. Sometimes juries are smarter than we think they are, and maybe it was true, complete optimism. Maybe he never intended, you know. And when we looked at Larson, you know, okay, I didn't try the case. I can only tell you my perception of it, but that's my view of it.
Okay, question in the back.
Yeah, it's been my observation, L-S-O-1.
The question is whether the church is too soft on white-collar criminals, especially compared to the damage that may have been done for a $20 stick-up. Any panel members want to respond? Joe?
I don't believe it's the church. I believe it's the culture and society we live in, and I believe what we have is a worldview, again, if I can use that term, that says if you are middle class and educated and striving, you can't have done such a bad thing unless you killed someone. Class is very important. We don't like to talk about that. Intention is very important. People want to do well. I don't think it's necessarily the church. I think the church is caught up in the kind of culture that Sam was talking about.
I think that the courts have treated it that way to some degree. I will tell you that many of you read the paper, and I don't know if you've read the prison case where the captain, because he was having sex with an inmate. That inmate was in the prison because he was a three-time shoplifter. He was in the damn prison, and he was a pretty young guy, and there's an enhancement thing in our statute that says if you get caught shoplifting for the third time, the third one's a felony. And there was a judge in a northern province county that sent him to prison for $5.33. And we have made it a practice in this Attorney General's administration that if you are a white-collar criminal, and if people are going to jail for shoplifting $5.33, you can be damned sure we're going to recommend incarceration every single time. And we've made that a policy, and we're trying to change that. Sometimes it's difficult. You know, the lawyers come in this guy's my friend, and his kids go to school with my kids. He looks like me. He acts like me. He's got the same kind of car that I've got, and went through the same sorts of school. He's culturally the same, and you have to say to yourself, look, this guy ruined someone else's lives, maybe 100 other lives. You know, people spent their entire life trying to amass some money for retirement or for the children, whatever, and it's gone. Wiped him out worse than a burglary could do, worse than an armed robbery could do. And to suggest to you, as the defense attorneys continually do, these are nice people. They've just gone astray a little bit, and they shouldn't go to prison. That kid that stole a Twinkie, he belongs in prison. It's so damned ludicrous that you want to cry when you hear it, but it's what we hear in our society.
Sam, do you think strong church action against white-collar criminals would, in fact, change some of the culture that you're concerned about?
I think it would. I thought Joe was going to respond with the network idea that he had brought up. I think it's insiders and outsiders, and I think it's both true in the church and in society. The white-collar criminals are one of our own, and so we treat them more lightly, and if we got rough with them, I think that would help.
Our first questioner again.
I just have a one-sentence question for Joe here. They're critical to the case.
The question is about the partnership agreements in the Granada case. Do they provide for the transfer of funds between partnerships?
As a general statement, the answer is no, and a judge has found probable cause to believe that that's the final statement, that the borrowing he did was out without written and without verbal authority.
Question toward the back.
Professor Bentley, concerning the, don't you see that these are simply a top level of a phenomenon that has existed throughout our society, and especially in our state, that goes down much more even to the pyramid schemes, to the set-rider corporations, to everybody that's selling all of their neighbors these household products and everything else? Isn't this just the top level of that type of situation we find throughout the state?
The question is the frauding at levels an extension of the way we transact with each other.
About the fraud per se. That's yeah. The profit motive of the Sunrider, the pyramids type. I'm going to sell all my neighbors, and I'm going to be a millionaire because everybody's going to be a sub distributor under me. Isn't that the same related phenomenon?
Are you connected with Amway? Or yes, I think that there are, in some ways, like answering very briefly, I think that you're talking about ways we have related historically to each other in a frontier society, which has been a barter society, it used to be, and that those relationships are very important. So I would agree with that.
How is the role playing?
Well, I believe very strongly that all of us intend to do well, including any institution, government, church, whatever. We are very easily persuaded, we persuade ourselves, that the ends in fact do justify any means if the ends are important enough. That's the way we are. And it's easy for us to be on the outside and criticize. We do the same thing. So I will lie, you will lie, if the welfare of my family is at stake. No question about it. I will steal, you will steal, if my children are hungry. No question about it. Now, when we connect that to person and exploitation of others is where I think we start committing, quotes, sin. But there are no absolute moralists in the world as far as I'm concerned. All of us are relativists. There is no absolute truth or absolute virtue or absolute goodness. It's always relative to the situation, the context, and the events that are facing us. The church protects the church. And it has to. It's an institution. All institutions have to survive. The church is no exception.
Other questions? Yes?
One follow-up question to Joe Tesh. Is it that there is nothing in the partnership agreements that gives them the authority, or is the authority there, but as the judge said, you cannot borrow from someone, no matter how much authority you have, if you have a reasonable expectation that you won't be able to pay it back? That's, I think, was the kind of a shocker to some of us that think, well, you know, borrowing isn't stealing what it is if you can't pay it back.
I don't know how to answer that. I wasn't there when the judge made his ruling. I do have a copy of the second amended information, which is what the judge found, which you're welcome to look at because I brought it around for example purposes if I needed it today. But he basically found there was no authority to borrow the money in that sense, was not, in that he couldn't say I didn't intend to steal it because there wasn't a likelihood. You know, I suppose if you say I'm just going to take it today, so to show it to somebody and then give it back tomorrow, they'd say there's no intent to permanently deprive. If you say I'm going to take it today to throw it to buy a new car so I can look successful, then I suppose you might say that there was an intent to permanently deprive. So somewhat fine distinctions.
Question on the front row.
You brought an interesting point on the Sheets case, that the Mormons really, in a sense, couldn't give Sheets a fair trial because they don't believe it to be good. Is it your thought about taking these cases out of state? No, I mean, it's a funny question, but they can't. The proneness is to get them off, right?
The question is, should we have a change of venue for highly placed and sympathetic figures in Mormon financial scams?
For the prosecutor's scam?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, this was an unusual case and I think was not well tried. We need to be more artful and better trial lawyers, but I have also seen as a defense attorney and as a prosecutor, I would rather not have a Mormon jury to try a minority. I think there is an effort in the Mormon community to bend over backwards for minorities. And having to defend or prosecute a black rapist in front of a jury or even sometimes a DUI case, a drunk driving case in front of a Mormon jury where the perpetrator was not of the culture, that there was an effort, I guess, to want to appear to be very fair or a very natural, for whatever, sympathy towards had the edge with a Mormon jury, and I think that's true. And I think Mormons can be as hard as anybody else on other Mormons.
Interesting.
Let me just add a comment from the psychological point of view. There is a saying which has great power, and if I've thought about it, and I think if you think about it, you'll see it. It's related to what Joe was just saying. To understand everything is to forgive everything. If you really understand someone's motives and reasons, if you take the time and energy to really listen and pay attention, to relate to that person in a humane way, then his or her behavior is understandable and should be forgiven. People don't go off to commit crime so they can become criminals. They have reasons and motives. So to understand everything is to forgive everything, and if you get people on the jury who are willing to forgive because of religious basis, then it does something to the principle of justice.
We've run out of time. I thank our panelists for being here. I'm not sure we have successfully answered all four questions that I posed when we began. However, this is an interesting issue. Unfortunately, I believe it will probably be a continuing issue. The last piece of advice I guess I should leave you with is keep your hand on your wallet. Thank you very much.
Well done, sir. You understood the motivations of the guy that hit you out of the 50,000 and therefore he's forgiven.
I forgave him.
I'm glad to hear that.